Guinea to attend technical and consultative meetings of ECOWAS, as well as all security-related meetings.
The three West African countries exited the ECOWAS and established what they called the Sahel Alliance after ECOWAS resolved to condemn the military coups in the three countries and to impose sanctions on them. Experts believe that there are solutions in the medium and long terms for solving the crisis in the regional economic body.
The issues I mentioned earlier of pan-Africanism, of resource nationalism, of ensuring that people are carried along in decision-making processes, of ensuring that there is equitable distribution of resources, of ensuring that people have access to the good things of life, of ensuring that the dividends of governance is brought to the people, must be addressed.
As one of the least developed regions in the world, the Sahel faces a multitude of challenges, including poverty, food security, poor governance and insecurity. Experts say some of these challenges are a matter of great concern, not just for the Sahel, but for the whole of Africa and beyond. They also noted that skillful diplomacy must be employed in addressing the exit of the three West African regions from the ECOWAS. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran Zamzam's company is poised to replace two major international soft drink brands in the region, driven by a growing boycott sentiment against Israeli army-associated products following the Gaza conflict. Having already entered markets in Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE, the company aims to export 4 million cans of its popular soda to Kuwait, making a significant milestone in its expansion efforts.
My concept revolved around organizing a festival exclusively showcasing Iranian products. However, following the conflict in Gaza and the overwhelming positive feedback we received, we expanded our vision to encompass Turkish and Kuwaiti products as well. The event is spanned 2 months, during which we received numerous requests for an extension. Our primary objective at the society remains to spotlight Iranian, Kuwaiti, and Turkish goods, particularly as consumers are actively seeking alternatives to products associated with Israel.
Zamzam's growth in the Persian Gulf soft drink market is reinforced by its official replacement status for soda drinks in Kuwait alongside local brands like LC and Kenzo. The Iranian-Turkish festival organized by the biggest societies in Kuwait, Al Jabriya, has been instrumental in promoting Zamzam and other locally made alternatives as primary substitutes for boycotted products, significantly boosting Zamzam's popularity and market presence in Kuwait.
We're also operating as a retail seller, catering to the demand for products from Iran, Turkey, and Kuwait, which many customers have been requesting. While we understand that implementing boycotts can be challenging to achieve rapidly, it's not unattainable. Therefore, in response to the tragic events in Gaza, we've completely redirected our focus towards promoting locally made products through a campaign titled Support Us Twice. The response has been phenomenal, with our sales soaring. Moreover, numerous other societies in Kuwait have chosen to follow suit and advocate exclusively for Iranian, Turkish, and locally produced goods.
The shift in consumer preference toward locally produced alternatives like Zamzam is emblematic of the broader economic repercussions of the conflict in Gaza. Major multinational corporations, including Starbucks, McDonald's, and Pepsi Cola, have experienced a significant decline in sales as consumers increasingly opt for products that align with their values and principles. As Zamzam continues to expand its footprint in the GCC countries, particularly in Kuwait, there is a shift in consumer behavior toward more regional products, and particularly the one from Iran, from other GCC countries, which is why the public in Kuwait is shifting into buying more products that are not associated in any way possible with the United States or Britain. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City, from Al Jabriya area.
Enemy's strategy against Iran's upcoming elections. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The elections of the Iranian Parliament, Majlis, and the Assembly of Experts are going to be held on the 1st of March. Thus, it is important to note the strategy of enemies of the Islamic Republic against this great event. The enemies have constantly applied a variety of tools and stratagems to defeat the Islamic Republic according to the conditions. The enemies have left no stone unturned to deal blows to Iran for the past 45 years, but they have intensified their hostilities for the past recent years due to the spectacular progresses the Islamic Republic has made both inside the country and in the global arenas. For the past recent years, the main strategy of the enemies of the Islamic Republic of Iran has been focused on forging of domestic crises through creation of rift between people and the ruling system in a bid to weaken the social asset and popular support of the system. This strategy has been strongly and persistently pursued for the upcoming elections of the Islamic Council Assembly and the Assembly of Experts, which are going to be held on Friday, March 1st. This strategy has been shaped around two approaches. The first approach is to prevent the holding of elections in due time. For the past 45 years, even a single election has not been delayed for a single hour, let alone a day. All elections have been held in due time, even during the eight-year imposed war, when the bombers of the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein were dropping bombs on people in various cities of Iran. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, and his successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, have always been opposed to delaying any election. According to the information gathered by the Iranian intelligence services, the enemies, especially the United States, have planned to orchestrate and continue the riots of autumn 2022 till the time of the upcoming elections in a bid to spread unrest and chaos in the country to postpone the elections. But thank God, they were frustrated and their plots were thwarted by the brave intelligence and security forces in Iran. The second approach of the enemies towards the upcoming elections is to persuade the people to ban the elections. They have tried many tricks and tactics to convince the people not to participate in determining their fate. As a matter of fact, the enemies are hell-bent on decreasing the number of voters to the lowest possible level. Tehran's Congregational Friday Prayer Leader, Hujjatul Islam Ali Akbari, said on the issue last Friday, "The enemies and the entire counter-revolutionary and counter-Iran current under the banner of the global unfaith have risen to confront the elections, and more than 500 nasty channels are disseminating lies against the elections." An expert of political issues also enumerated the tactics of the enemies to dissuade the people from participating in the elections as follows. Number one, frustrating people, including those who are loyal to the revolution, not to take part in the elections. Number two, suggestion of ineffectiveness of elections in reforming of the country. Number three, ignoring of achievements and strong points of the system in different scientific, industrial, defensive, international, and other arenas. Number 4. Tying the problems of the country to the strategies and policies of the system. And number 5, delegitimizing the system through suggestion of lacking people's support. Ayatollah Khamenei reiterated on February 19th, "There is no doubt that the front of arrogance is opposed to our elections. Why are they opposed? Because our system is Islamic Republic. It has two parts. They are opposed both to its republic and Islamic. The symbol of republic is this very election. This election is the symbol of republic. So, when America is opposed to the Islamic Republic system, it means that it is opposed to election. It is opposed to the fervor and excitement in election and people's more participation." Now the question that comes to mind is, why are the enemies trying to persuade the Iranian people not to participate in the elections? It seems that three goals are pursued by the enemies through this persuasion. The first goal is to delegitimize or at least undermine the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic system. The enemies of Iran are exerting their utmost to bring the people's participation to below 50% and even 40%. They thought if strongly pumped through media hype, while in some European countries, people's turnout is always below 50%. And in the recent parliamentary election in Pakistan, the number was 48%. However, this event wasn't translated as the illegitimacy of the ruling system. The second goal pursued by the enemies to persuade the Iranians not to participate in the upcoming election is to reduce the popular support and social asset of the Islamic Republic. The avowed enemies of Iran have realized that people's support is the most important source of power for the Islamic Republic. 5 years ago, the enemies wished the Islamic Revolution would not see its 40th anniversary, but God favored, and this revolution celebrated the 45th anniversary of its glorious victory. The leader of the Islamic Revolution said in Nowruz of the current Iranian year, almost 1 year ago, that the main goal of the enemies is to deal blow the strong points of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Finally, the third goal of that the enemies pursue from persuading the people not to participate in the elections is to aggravate external pressures against Iran in the global arenas. Monitoring the behavior of the enemies, especially imposition of illegal sanctions against Iran, indicates that whenever people's turnout has been low, foreign pressures are intensified, whereas when this turnout is high, they choose diplomatic approaches. Thus, if the people's turnout is high in the upcoming elections, the enemies will be dumbfounded and frustrated once more, inshallah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hepsi yuttu.
Çömen.
Yani?
Bazaar.
It is said nearly 70% of the world's protein comes from animal sources. While the plant-based trend is popular for the time being, meat is here to stay. Protein is also a brain food, vital for neurological and other bodily functions. Moreover, globally, the relationship between humans and livestock is fascinating. It has transcended time and space. Yet, despite all the world's technological and scientific accomplishments, mankind has failed to replicate livestock's exact contributions to food, clothing, and even energy.
Hello there, and welcome to the second segment in our two-part edition of Bazaar. Last week, we discussed the knowledge-based production of potatoes in agriculture and how technology has helped expand this sector. This week, the program focuses on livestock rearing and all that goes into producing high-quality meat and dairy. Yum, yum. So stay with us as we check out their economic and national food security contributions. Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested. Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card, so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs. Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics.
They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products.
In 2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production.
Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit. Khorasan Razavi province specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechie, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini tubers. So what is a mini tuber? They are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production. You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a solace system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production. As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production.
it's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use. Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received 3 consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress. As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products. The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy. Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same two-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
Well, I'm going to go into a several-minute silence because my good friend and colleague is out there on the field to give you guys a wonderful report. Take it away.
In a world grappling with coronavirus, a significant number of health-related companies have been looking for a solution to contain the spread of the virus. With the development of various testing methods, there has been a huge spike in demand for the virus sampling kits, and especially the sampling swabs.
God, I'm just so very tired of wearing masks. But what can I say? Ever since the pandemic took the world by storm, our life has changed in an unpredictable way. One of the prominent changes is the development of sampling technology to meet the evolving need of COVID-19 testing. Today, we came to Damahi Biotechnology Company to see how the sampling swabs that we see everywhere are produced. So don't go anywhere, stay with me.
At the start of the outbreak, Most of the sampling swabs were imported into the country and the domestic supply chain had been inconsistent. For this reason, this Iranian company in biotechnology decided to take steps towards promoting local sampling swabs on a large scale. When it comes to production, the swabs are produced in two different forms, oral swabs and nasal swabs. Anyway, let's take a look at the production line.
Alright, the production process of the sampling swabs begins in this unit. At this stage, after the plastic handles are imported into this factory, they go through the swab flocking machine to form the header. Actually, when I look at it, it kind of looks like the ear cleaning swabs that we use on a day-to-day basis. But in fact, they are completely different. These headers are actually made of fibers, so it's totally something else. When the swabs are produced, they get to this stage for quality control and cleaning before they get to the packing hall. And finally, they pass through the sealer machine for pressing. But I should mention that the swabs are not finalized at this stage. They have to go through the sterilization process, and by the end of the day, the sterilized swabs are transported to different laboratories all across the country.
In case you wonder about the head of the swab, unlike how we thought earlier that it looks like the ear cleaning swab, the foam-headed material eliminates the possibility of adhesive residue contamination. So by the end, the sterilized sampling swabs are distributed for field or home testing to meet the growing need of the country.
Even though it looks very simple, the production procedure of the sampling swabs is very complicated. Now, thanks to the development of such diagnostic tools, the world has managed to curb the pandemic in numerous ways. I've been Sarah Dema. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Many thanks for that fantastic adventure. That wraps up our program for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
To our ports.
Hajja Fatima was born in 1948. This was the year Palestinians refer to as Al-Nakba, the catastrophe, when Israel wiped the Palestinian inhabitants from 400 villages. Some they entirely destroyed, others were repopulated with Jewish immigrants. Hajja Fatima was born in the field while her father fought in the war. Within days of her birth, her family fled to Beit Anan in the West Bank, which is where she has remained her entire life.
First of all, this is my land and my country. It is not only the 1948 or 1967 borders from the sea to the river, 27,000 square kilometers. I am not ready to let go of a centimeter. This is historical Palestine. Al-Quds. Jerusalem, the most important one, the capital. This is Bab al-Shams and this is Bab al-Karameh. The Jordan Valley has been conquered and taken over by the Israelis.
Hey.
Here is Jenin. We will never let go of this area. And north is the Galilee, now ruled by Israel. My mother brought me into this world on the 14th of July 1948, the day of the Nakba. I was born in a field and left for 24 hours while my father fought in the war. I now fight with my words. Although this is my only weapon, I'm strong because I'm right.
Since her exile, Haji Fatima has witnessed dramatic changes in the landscape surrounding her home. From the construction of the Israeli wall, which eventually encircled her home, to the gradual building of Israeli settlements, which engulfed what was once Palestinian agricultural land. Her town was once considered the safest path to walk to the holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
The last time I visited Jerusalem, Al-Quds, was 7 years ago. But it is now forbidden by the Israelis. They forbid me from everything that I hold dear to me, praying in Al-Aqsa Mosque, buying sweet cakes from the old markets of Jerusalem, and walking through the ancient path of the old city. There is no place more beautiful than Jerusalem. I would love to be there just to see the markets, the shops, the old streets, and to pray in Al-Aqsa Mosque. Bab al-Karameh was built because it is the western entrance for Jerusalem. It is near Jerusalem, and this is why we built this village and named it Karameh. It means our pride.
Haji Fatima described the land to me, stating, "The land is our bed and the blankets our sky." Palestine to Haji Fatima is not exclusively about the land itself, but the Palestinians' relationship to their land. She told me that people can and will continue to live from the land, and only when their livelihood is taken, that will be the end of Palestine. Fatima sews each village and city into the map of Palestine, without borders, without boundaries, without settlements, without Israeli cities, and without the infamous wall built by Israel to separate what is now called Israel to the West Bank.
We want peace and they want peace. Our weapons is the rock and words. But we are rightful people. This is our land. Our ancestors are from here. Since 1968 they have been excavating tunnels, found a trace of evidence or antiquities. All of these antiquities are Arab, Muslim, Christian. We and our fellow Christians live together here. Jerusalem has the Church of Holy Sepulchre, and it has Al-Aqsa Mosque. Whoever they want to imprison, let them imprison. Who they want to kill, let them kill. If they want to take a tree, we will plant 1,000. They break and we build. We are here for a long time. We are never going to be bored. They asked me, why do you see Palestine like this? This is my country, and I can draw it as I want and make it more beautiful.
Fatima joined Palestinian and international activists from around the world in building the protest village Bab el-Karama.
They didn't leave their land or houses, and therefore they became refugees in their own homeland. Jerusalem is near, only a few meters from here, so we consider Beit Iksa to be the western gate for Jerusalem. If they take this village, we wouldn't be able to reach Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is our capital, the capital of the Palestinian state. Whether they like it or not, it's ours and not theirs. We are here today because they are going to take this land to build the wall through it, and we do not approve that. It is the land of our fathers and grandfathers, and also the land of our sons and grandchildren.
About 1,200 hectares of from Beit Iksa land, and it just leaves about 2,000 hectares for the city, for the village itself. This is what had happened, and this is what they are looking to do it. The train that passes from near here in this neighborhood was passed from the lands of Beit Iksa, and the Israelis want to keep the citizens here far away from the bus of the train and the wall. That's why they separate the land.
Well, I was at the Bab el-Shams protest last week, and I myself had my head banged against a bus by a soldier. The bus I was put on to be taken away from Bab el-Shams, there was a man with he had a busted eye and a bleeding nose, and the soldiers would not let him receive medical attention.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, Maliki Yawmiddin.
In this day, Al-Jum'ah, they pray here in their land because they know keeping their land is part of their religious and beliefs. For though here in Beit Iksa, the village that was surrounded by the wall from the whole parts, from the whole directions, only one path. This path is come and go through the gate that is run by the Israeli soldiers. If you want to enter, you have to give them your ID and tell them why and when you are come to enter Beit Iksa. This is the exact separation. Beit Iksa is living in a big jail here.
It's very clear that the settlements and the theft of land are illegal. The UN has repeatedly condemned it. Members of Amnesty International and other human rights organisations, they've all condemned it. It's just every attempt made to fix the situation is blocked by the US.
Ed Knight described to me that he barely sees the situation on the ground in the news, including settlements, construction and Israeli apartheid.
I think since the experience of the initiative of Bab el-Shams, it has been exposed the Israeli settlements much more and the Israeli confiscation of the land much more. It's became have lots of interest in, within the international media, international community. And I think this is what we are doing now. If you continue this kind of initiative, they will challenge them more and more. And they will bring it from like a kind of a media coverage to political levels. And that's what we want. We want everybody to be accountable and responsible for this, because Israel is here, like any, by the support of Europe, by the support of the United States. Like, here, they are accountable, as Israel is accountable for what's going on.
The villagers assembled for prayers on the hill. Following this, they erected a tent structure and laid the first bricks for a new mosque they call Karama, meaning dignity.
You know, Beit Iksa's land is confiscated, like, and now I have no land whatsoever. This is the last piece of land that has been confiscated, which is 450 dirhams. So the strategy here is to come and to build the tents, as you see here, and to stay in the land. So people is living, staying here, sleeping here, staying 24 hours in this land, telling the Israelis one message, the Israeli occupation. This is our land, we are not going to give it easy. You can give orders of like any confiscations, you can give orders of expulsion, but we are going to defend our land. We are going to stay in our land. And this is an open battle, you know, with the Israeli occupation power. So we have no choice but to resist.
This is very symbolic because back in 1948, when the state of Israel was established, the villagers here had 15,000 dulums of land. Right away, 14,000 of those 15 were taken away. And recently, they're trying to take away another 700 of the, so basically they're going to be left with 300 dulums. The village here needs more than that to survive. They have a lot of land that they need to grow food and survive on that. So the Zionist plan is to basically build a wall around the village and between the village and their lands so they can't grow, they can't use it for agriculture to sustain themselves.
Even with immense international support, Israel handed the activists a notice of demolition. They destroyed the mosque and ordered all people to leave the area.
We've been here for 3 days. They always come. Today, Israelis raided our village twice. Of course we prevented them, as we will do every day. At the beginning, they used to build the wall and we would follow them. But now it is the opposite. They follow us. That is why we are staying here. They closed the checkpoint and prevented anyone from entering. Days ago, the eastern gates of Jerusalem, Bab al-Shams, it is called that because the sun rises from the east, and this one is Bab al-Karameh. So instead of Israel surrounding us, we will surround them because we are the people with the rights to the land. The one who has the right is the strongest.
Area is agricultural land, you know, and now we are surrounded with the settlements, and this area it's in the history the main road to Jerusalem, and the Israelis settlements cutting this main road and cutting the main road to the Ramallah.
We have come here today to construct Canaan village on our land, our Palestinian land, to practice our right to develop our land, to plant our land, to use our land. This is our natural right as human beings, to use our land. That's why we are here today. When we arrived to the area, Israeli occupation or fascist Israeli occupation forces has attacked us, has demolished the tents, stolen the tents, but we are telling them clear message. They have demolished Canaan village here. We will today, not tomorrow, we will build another village in another area in Yatta, today.
We took the case to the High Court for petition to state that this is privately owned land. We were able to get an order from the High Court to not take the camp down for 6 days. However, the army stormed the camp under the pretext of security and announced it as a military closed zone for this period of time. I was shocked that I was unable to enter my own land.
Now we are living in miserable conditions. Because we are cutting from the other areas from Ramallah and Jerusalem. We haven't any work. Our agricultural, all of our agricultural land now is behind Of the wall.
The
Israeli soldiers told us it was a military closed zone until the 13th of February. I was shocked to see that he had a legal warrant from the head of the IDF to extend the matter to the 13th of February. After the end of the 6 days, the Israeli court granted the Israeli forces permission to take the tents down. This was permitted under a false and unreasonable pretext, security. The area is isolated. There are no Israeli highways or military bases. No danger towards Israelis whatsoever. It is open land. I strongly object to this excuse that it is a military zone. This is merely an excuse. This, for example, is a title deed from Turkey that proves that we are the landowners. This deed entitles Salah Ali Jama and all the people of Tor to this land, which includes my family for generations. This title proves that these people are the rightful owners. Only the owners of this land have the rights to it.
Baba Shams was completely encircled by the Israeli army. All protesters were evacuated, and Palestinians are now banned from the area. Although Mofid gained permission from the High Court to remain on the land for an additional week, the Israeli police refused this petition and dispersed the protesters without warning or warrant.
2 weeks ago, there was an open day near the wall. We marched towards it and planted olive trees and buried with them the names of martyrs killed by Israel. The soldier attempted to stop us, but we continued digging. The soldiers came, but we did not allow them to destroy our work. We resist. Our work is on the land.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.